What is today? Oh, today is Tuesday. It's the 7th of Rabiu Thani, 1447 of the Islamic Lunar Hijri calendar, corresponding to the 8th of the month of Mehr, 1404 of the Islamic Solar Hijri calendar, and the 13th of September, 2025 of the Christian Gregorian calendar. The month of Mehr is a beautiful month for the Iranians because schools and universities start at this month and all the students happily go to their schools. Stay with us and let's beautify ourselves. Let's have the fragrant aroma of the ayahs of the Holy Quran and let's bless our mouths with reciting an ayah of the Holy Quran. Brother Mahmoud, the producer, has selected ayah 62 of Surah An-Naml for today. Let's listen to the Arabic recitation along with the English translation, and then we'll be back in a minute. Please stay tuned.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. أَمَّنْ يُجِيبُ الْمُضْطَرَّ إِذَا دَعَاهُ وَيَكْشِفُ السُّوءَ وَيَجْعَلُكُمْ خُلَفَاءَ الْأَرْضِ أَإِلَهٌ مَّعَ اللَّهِ قَلِيلًا مَّا تَذَكَّرُونَ.
Is he not best who responds to the desperate one when he calls upon him and removes evil and makes you inheritors of the earth? Is there a deity with Allah? Little do you remember.
La ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah.
Bless your day with contemplation on the verses of the Holy Quran.
Welcome back. You're listening to today's special with me, Atta, the host of this program. I am very much honored to host this program this time. At the time when all the doors of the world means are shut to a man and he is helpless from any point of view, the only one who can unlock the lock of difficulties brings the light of hope into the heart and opens the doors of mercy to the distressed ones is only his pure essence, not anyone else. His pure essence, all of them with capital. Who is he? Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. In view of the fact that this reality as a natural feeling is inside the soul of all human beings, idol worshippers also forget all their objects and worship when they entangle with the huge waves of the sea and refer to the grace of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Never forget Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in your life. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will never forget you. He is all-knowing, all-powerful. Stay with us and then we'll get to today's health tip, oral health, scientific findings, and Islamic perspectives. Please stay tuned.
My life is not the same when I'm too concerned by what they say. Why should I wanna have you? To doubt you would be the worst mistake. Deep inside I know, amidst all the darkness and everything which makes no sense, I know that you exist. You are the light. You guides me through my darkest nights. Shows me right from wrong in a world that often lies. Cause I don't need anyone, anything in life but you.
Welcome back. You're listening to today's special with me, Atta, the host of this program. Never forget Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in any moment, second in your life. Never lose hope. Satan will easily reach you through hopelessness. Now, let's get to today's hygiene topic. Islam teaches hygiene in every aspect of humans' lives. Why? Because it includes the hygiene of various parts of the body, oral hygiene, gender-based hygiene, sleep hygiene, food hygiene, dress hygiene, environmental hygiene, etc. One of the aspects of hygiene which Islam has a stress upon is oral hygiene. Oral hygiene? What is it? The Prophet Muhammad emphasized, as well as demonstrated, the importance of maintaining oral hygiene on various occasions. Allah's Messenger, that is Prophet Muhammad, said, "I have told you repeatedly to use the siwak." The prayer before which the miswak is utilized is 70 times more superior to that before which is not used. So siwak or miswak is the same brush we use today. The Prophet said to offer 2 rakahs after using the miswak is more beloved to me than offering 70 rakahs without using the siwak. Now some of you might say, "I don't have miswak right now in the masjid. I don't have miswak right now at my workplace, or I am in a gym, I don't have miswak." Use your finger. Yes, use your finger. You can just rinse your mouth and teeth and brush your teeth with your finger, with your index finger, okay? Just put a little bit, with a little bit of salt is also is good, okay? Just put a little bit of salt, piece of salt on that, and put it in your mouth. Open it and rinse your mouth, put water in your mouth, just gargle it and then out. And then do your salat easily, 70 times more superior than you did that before it was not used. Happy for you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his purified progeny. Dear brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum and welcome to yet another edition. Today we are going to talk about oral health. That is, the scientific findings and Islamic perspectives on oral health specifically. The Islamic tradition also contains recommendations for nutrition that can positively impact oral health. The moderate consumption of sweets and the emphasis on natural, unprocessed foods align with modern dental advice. Current research on oral health confirms in remarkable ways what has long been practiced in Islamic traditions, while scientists like Eric Reynolds at the University of Melbourne are working on vaccines against gum disease. We can simultaneously learn from traditional practices. Research by Laura Weirich from Pennsylvania State University shows that the oral microbiome of our ancestors drastically deteriorated after the transition from a hunter-gatherer society to an agricultural lifestyle about 8,000 years ago. With increasing intake after the transition from a hunter-gatherer society to an agricultural lifestyle about 8,000 years ago, with the increasing intake of carbohydrates, the composition of the oral flora changed in favor of bacteria causing caries. These findings align with the Islamic recommendation for moderation in eating and avoiding excess.
Special topics for a special program. You can listen today, now and here, IRIB English Radio. Today's special.
Now let's get to the spiritual aspects of oral hygiene. A clean mouth during recitation is more important because the angels who normally come close to the reciter are repelled by foul smells. Imam Ali alayhi salam narrated that Prophet Muhammad said, "When a servant uses a toothpick, then stands for the salat, an angel stands behind him and listens to his recitation. The angel then comes so close to him that he places his mouth against the mouth of that person." Wow. If your mouth smells bad what that angel will be feeling. Not only the angel, also the people who are with you in Salat al-Jama'ah in the masjid. Consider, for example, you had garlic or onion or any type of bad smell type of food. And then you go to the masjid. And then you want a prayer. And then say, Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Wow. As long as you open your mouth, bad smell is coming out. Bad smell is coming out. The people who are beside you say, wow, feeling, you know, messy. They feel not happy about your mouth. They do not feel happy about the smell of your mouth. So, do the miswak, have itr, and then go to the masjid. Please, please, please. The Prophet, who was an example of how we take care of our oral hygiene, was especially meticulous when angel Jibril came to him. He shared, never did Jibril came to me without commanding me to use the toothpick, with the result being that I was afraid of shoving the front of my mouth. With the result being that I was afraid of chafing the front of my mouth. That's it, that's it, that's it. That was today's tip. Let's get to a break time. Agree? And then we'll listen to tips to boost your oral hygiene routine. Thank you very much, Brother Mahmoud, for nice practical points in your program. Today's special, dear listeners, I'm very much honored to have you. Be with us, please. Tips to boost your oral hygiene routine. Start by brushing in the back. This good habit may mean that you do a better job cleaning those hard-to-reach spots, which is essential because of all those nooks and crannies in your molars make them more susceptible to gum disease and cavities. Beginning your brushing routine in the rear, at least sometimes a good way to give the back of your mouth the attention it deserves. Every time I brush my teeth, I start in the upper right side in the back. Dr. Lynch, the Global Director of Oral Care and Fellow Global Scientific Engagement Incorporation, says, and I always follow the same method so I know I won't miss any spots. That's it. Usually when you do the miswak, do the brushing of the teeth, the front teeth are easier to reach. You do them, okay, they look white. When people look at you, what about the back ones? Come on, take care of your back teeth. And they are mostly susceptible to cavities and gum problems. Using miswak before salat, before doing your spiritual recitation of the Holy Quran, will really, really increase the rewards of your recitation and your salat. Believe me, do that and then be among the people with a happy face. Do not forget to smile with your beautiful teeth and beautiful aroma of the mouth.
Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam has said, when the stomach is healthy, the veins transmit health, and when the stomach is ill, the veins transmit illness, which emphasizes the importance of balanced diet. Regular tooth brushing with fluoride toothpaste, the use of dental floss and interdental brushes may not exactly match traditional methods, but they fulfill the same purpose. The use of the miswak can be considered a complementary measure that offers both religious and health benefits.
Thank you very much for staying with us with today's special with me, Atta, the host of this program. We hope you enjoyed and benefited from today's topic, which was oral hygiene and oral health from Islamic perspective and also scientific perspective. Please, for more information, visit our website, our new website, iranradio.ir. To another episode, God bless you all. Take care. Fi amanallah.
They told me that I'm crazy. Who you praying for? They told me there is nothing. Who you looking for? Stop doing what you're doing, 'cause there is no hope. Just come with me, I'll show you what's behind your door. And they showed me all kind of lies. My eyes were locked, yes, I was mesmerized. But deep inside I know that there's a better world. 'Cause I'm a believer. I'm a believer. Before over a million times, who would ever thought that it would be our time? I just know it, 'cause you're the one. It ain't a selfish love when I'm with you. Remind me of the moment so I know it's true. I'll just say it, you are the one. Won't you be my BFF forever? Won't you be my partner after this world? We'll see when we believe it together. Dreams are meant to be, 'cause you're the one. Every single day, I'll just say it, 'cause you're the one. And when times are tough, we've got the world to see. Standing right beside you is where I wanna be. I just know it, you are the one. Won't you be? About this just over a million times. Who had ever thought that I could call you mine? I just know it, 'cause you're the one. And when there's gray in our hair, we've not much to do. I wanna spend the rest of my days with you. Oh, don't you know it? You are the one. Won't you be the one?
send me a piece or I am lost for sure.
Hadith of the day.
Here I am yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
You are listening to the program Hadith of the Day on Iran Radio with Sheikh Danish.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Dear brothers and sisters, salam, and welcome to this episode of the Hadith of the Day. In one of the most critical and defining moments of history, the day Mecca was conquered, when the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him and his holy progeny, had every worldly reason to claim victory and power, he stood before the people and said something that shattered the social hierarchies of his time and ours. He proclaimed, "O people, your Lord is one, and your father, Adam, is one. There is no superiority for an Arab over a non-Arab, nor for a non-Arab over an Arab. No superiority for a white over a black, nor for a black over a white, except by taqwa." And I will tell you about taqwa, what it is. Then he asked, "Have I delivered the message?" The people replied, "Yes." He said, "Let those who are present convey it to those who are absent." So this was not just a sermon, it was a declaration, a revolutionary announcement that tore down tribal pride, racism, nationalism, and classism, all in a single sentence. You know, at that time, in that society, most of the people, I can say, they were so attached to their tribes, and they would consider all the other people, especially the non-Arabs, as not as less than them. So the Prophet didn't just preach unity, he practiced it. Bilal, a black former slave, was the one who he called to stand on the Kaaba, the house of God, and proclaim the Adhan, the call to prayer. Salman the Persian was called from the Ahlul Bayt. And Suhaib the Roman was honored like a brother. Islam didn't come to polish the old system, it came to replace it. But here's the hard truth. Many of us still carry the disease of superiority today. Modern studies confirm what the Prophet said 14 centuries ago. Howard's implicit association test shows that unconscious bias exists in most people, even when they claim to believe in equality. People assume others as less smart, less trustworthy, less worthy, just based on their skin color, ethnicity, accent, or poverty. But in the eyes of Allah, all of that means nothing. What matters is your taqwa, your sincerity, your humility, your heart. Taqwa is what gets you close to Allah, how you stay pure from every impurity. And that's only a criterion that Allah can recognize, no one else. You cannot just put someone forward ahead and first because, okay, he has more taqwa. No, that's only in the eyes of Allah, and he can discern. So how can we live this hadith today? Catch hidden bias and ask yourself, are you biased? And honor the unknown people. You don't know them. They may be better than you. And celebrate diversity. Don't tolerate it. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
You just listened to the program Hadith of the Day on Iran Radio with Sheikh Danish.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Thinkers who refuse to follow the script, who question the machinery of global power and offer alternative visions rooted in lived experience and historical depth. My guest today is one such figure, a scholar activist whose journey has taken him from the lecture halls of Sydney to the front lines of international resistance. His work invites us to reconsider what we think we know about sovereignty, development, and the forces that shape our world. Welcome to SOAP. I am Bahman Ray.
Tim Anderson is an Australian political economist, writer and activist known for his critiques of Western imperialism and advocacy for independent development. Formerly a senior lecturer at the University of Sydney, his academic work spans decades and includes books on Latin America, Syria and global resistance movements. His career has been marked by both scholarly contributions and public controversy, including legal battles over academic freedom.
Mr. Tim Anderson, very good to finally see you in person.
Thank you.
And thank you for coming to the show.
Very welcome.
Tim, is it all right for me to call you Tim for the sake of the interview? What first sparked your interest in political economy and global justice?
I think I was growing up during one of the post-World War II wars. And of course, the involvement of my own country in Vietnam had a very deep impact on me when I was at school and when I was at university. And then there was also the civil rights movement in the US, and that flowed on to the indigenous rights movement in Australia. So those things together had a very big influence on me on the way that I saw the world, I think.
And what did you decide to do about it in order to kind of gain some knowledge regarding what you were feeling at the time?
Well, there was something very wrong, even when I was very young, to me about the idea of going to Vietnam, sending young men to Vietnam to kill people there in their country. What was the point of that? And then when it came to the indigenous rights movement, this idea of the self-determination of a people became very important to me and still very important today. It's very formative in terms of the way I look at international relations and struggles around the world. Resistance, in a way, is the flip side of self-determination. So it led me a long way, but really I was thinking about that at the time, and of course I was inspired by the independence movements in the 70s in particular, you know, and that's why I was interested in Latin America, and I went to Latin America later on.
Right, and these could be like formative experiences that kind of shaped your worldview, and then in terms of studies, how did you decide to proceed?
The same thing, really. I went to university to study science because I liked nature, and I thought I'd be interested in scientific studies, but eventually I moved back into the humanities and into social sciences and into political economy eventually, because I think I realized that economics was important and I shouldn't be ignorant about it. But then I came back to this idea of self-determination and resistance, and those themes that have run through what I've been writing for a very long time, particularly in recent years.
Right, and what school of political economy are you a fan of?
Well, we had a pluralist approach in the department I was in for about 20 years, so we had to teach, in a sense, political economic literacy to students. So they had to understand liberalism, Marxism, institutionalism, other type feminism, other types of ideologies, different ways of looking at the same issues, which I think was useful pedagogically, you know. But then in terms of analysis, of course, for me it was always horses for courses. There were particular types of methods you would apply to particular types of problems. So I didn't really dedicate myself or commit myself to one particular line of ideology, for example.
So do you think that each of the models would be suitable depending on the region where they are applied, or do you think there could be one formula for the entire world?
Look, there are human values behind all of them, basically, and I think that's important. I was influenced by a few different schools, the Indian esotericism, Latin American humanism. Now, the humanism in Latin America applied to other cultures and across different religions became very important to me. And I've had the privilege in my life to visit many, many cultures. I've been in dozens of different cultures and tried to be someone who could read and listen to people. And it occurred to me, traveling from, you know, Pacific Islands to the Arab world and Latin America, that there were some common values that crossed cultures. People really understood those things, and they were values formed in older traditional cultures, although modernist thought makes us think of tradition as something that weighs people down. But I came to accept that tradition had a lot of very valuable human values, and they did cross cultures, and so therefore other cultures could understand each other. There was a type of a common language, a human type of language that crossed those sorts of cultures. And there was very good values in all cultures in some way. Of course, there were bad things in all cultures too. But nevertheless, I saw that link between different cultures. That was one of the things I learned from visiting many different cultures, and including indigenous cultures. You know, when you see the type of hospitality and reciprocity and types of human connections in the Arab world, in the indigenous world, in the Pacific, then you think there's something here that actually is not really to do with their specific histories. Specific histories are important, but I think the things that connect us as human beings are very important too.
Well, focusing on indigenous people and the justice system that they had, the judicial system that they had, do you believe that, with the kind of knowledge that you have regarding them, do you believe that the modern world has been able to create a system that is as valuable as those old traditional systems?
No, I don't think so. I think there are some benefits of modernism, but there's also imperial modernism, you know, so there are modernism as a construct completely is not an answer to anything really, and the problem is the fact that it can destroy some very valuable traditional values and cultures and ways of managing the earth, for example, is extremely important. One of the things I was talking about with some friends here in Tehran this week is the link between the environmental movement and the genocide in Gaza. You know, that really, that there's something very important that's missing in the environmental movement if it doesn't include the sustainable reproduction of human life and human values. And that's perhaps what's missing in the environmental movement now. So I think there are lessons from all sides here, and in the formation of some human ideologies, we have to take account of many, many aspects, whether they're traditional or modern.
Right, that was a very beautiful way of putting this. You mentioned the genocide in Gaza, and looking at it from an environmental point of view, that was, for me, it was a first, and it was very interesting and really touched a certain spot in me. How do you think we can bring this sort of talk to the mainstream media?
Look, it's a battle of ideas. As the late Fidel Castro said, we are engaged in a battle of ideas and trying to promote human values. And the problem is that we have some very institutionalized, hegemonic, domineering ideas. And when you talk about the mass media, really you're talking about a media which in a sense is a key forward part of that hegemonic project. You know, it's really the enemy in many respects of human values. So therefore independent media and alternative media and the media from voices that aren't, or subaltern voices as they sometimes say, become more important. We have some opportunities now, but in many respects I don't think it's important to focus on changing those ossified institutions that represent hegemonic values. I really think we have to bypass them and create some new institutions, some new cultures in the world.
Right, so you mentioned the role of alternative media, for example. How do you think they can kind of fill in the gap which is left intentionally, if you say so, by the mainstream media in the world?
Look, there are some spaces in what you call the mainstream media, what I typically call the colonial media or the corporate media. There are spaces there, it's true. There are spaces in which we can use our voices, our genuine voices. Sometimes there are limits placed on that. But then we also have to construct some realities where we can talk about actual realities. This was the basis of the Latin Americans, for example, creating Telesur 20 years ago, where they were dominated by a North American Spanish-speaking television system like CNN, for example. And in creating Telesur, the late Hugo Chavez of Venezuela said, this is where our voices come out. And it's a very successful experiment, and it still lasts, and it's got shareholdings and voices from the whole continent of Latin America. So it's an example of what can be done with, for example, television. But I think it's really the political relationship is to try to displace the reliance on or the monopoly of those hegemonic outlets.
Right. I want to know, what drew you to focus on Latin America and the global south in your research?
I think because there were such outstanding examples of struggles for self-determination and creating different societies. We could say experiments in a way, because many of them failed. But nevertheless, the attempts were very important. And in the Global South, you will see people have a much more faith in being able to try and construct a new society than in the Western countries, where there's a great deal of cynicism, where it's seen that the state is embedded with autocratic elites and there is no chance to change them at all. Whereas in Latin America, for example, you had the election of a democratic left president, Salvador Allende. We heard that you had this Cuban Revolution. You've had a lot of initiatives. We had the revolution in China, in Vietnam, the struggle for independence in Vietnam. So there are many more inspiring stories from the Global South than in the West, where really there's been very little rejection of oligarchic or autocratic rule in the European societies, for example. So there's much more to be learned, I believe, from society and the state in the Global South.
Right, so in the talk, the argument of the Global South and the Latin American experience that you've had, how close do you find it with the discourse that you hear here in Tehran?
There are very strong links, and I now that you mention that link, I have to point out that the most popular of my tweets on what used to be called Twitter in the recent days has precisely been the relationship with Iran and Venezuela. Now that both countries are under threat and both countries are collaborating in a very material sense in their defense industries, for example. So I know that collaboration has been going on for quite some time, but nevertheless, people in the world, and most of the audience of my social media is English speaking, and probably most of that in North America, but they're very interested in new collaborations, new networks. You know, networks has become increasingly important to me in my life, and when they see real collaborations that breaks the cycle of cynicism and the idea that nothing really changes and, you know, money rules and so on, that enormous amount of cynicism really dominates a lot of thinking in the West. So people wake up a little bit when they see something going on. Oh, there could be something here, you know, could be something different here.
Right, and Ben, I want to talk about the reactions that you get on your X account today. You know, when you talk about these links between Iran and Venezuela in particular, what kind of reactions do you see?
Well, people I'm talking about mainly English-speaking people, I suppose, also
right.
Latin American-speaking people, because my second language is Spanish, so I also write some things in Spanish, but it's mainly English-speaking. there can be new relations, there can be some break in the monolithic power structures that they've grown up under, and they don't see any hope. They feel like they are a great weight is placed on their shoulders, and where is the possibility of liberation in this monolithic world, basically? And so that's why the talk, which I believe began in Russia, but it was popularized in Latin America, the idea of a multipolar world has really become an inspiring idea. But when people see practicality of it, they're inspired. I myself am inspired by the fact, for example, that Cuban medicines are manufactured in Iran and then exported back to Latin America, for example, because Cuba has great innovations in pharmaceutical industries, for example. But to see that sort of cooperation working in a practical sense, or to put it another way, I've spent a lot of time on this, the Cuban training of doctors, many, many doctors in my part of the world in developing countries, has been an extraordinary program, and it's something the wealthy countries haven't been able to do at all. But then you see real results, like the training of 1,000 doctors in East Timor, for example, by the Cubans, and they are working there, and they haven't left the country in the brain drain. They've stayed there as salaried public servants working for their communities. It's really an incredibly inspiring story. So those sorts of things really give me some sort of hope, too, about what's possible today.
Right. That's of course, very inspiring to see this sort of collaboration between these countries trying to come up with their own chain of value, but with their own system. But yeah. How far do you think are we from an actual multipolar world?
We are still some way from that, because there's some famous saying by the late Italian communist Antonio Gramsci, but that the new order is being born, but the old one hasn't died yet. So that we're in the middle of all these wars, all these hybrid wars now. People talk about World War III, but really what we're faced with these days is a very large number of hybrid wars, which are not global conflagrations, but they're very serious for all the people that involve them, of course. And of course, all of them are rooted back to either the US or the NATO countries, basically. That's where the great threat to humanity is coming from today. I'm quite convinced of it. The US and its NATO allies.
Right. And this world order that you just mentioned, today, especially in the Middle East, of course, we are seeing all the West Asia region, as we call it, we are facing something really new. I think something that has never been experienced before.
Yeah.
Today that we were speaking, yesterday we witnessed an aggression by the Israeli forces in Qatar. Qatar is a friendly country to the U.S.,
mm-hmm.
and the U.S. is so much promoting the idea of Abraham Accords,
mm-hmm.
but the Israelis seem to go on very roguely, to say the least. And these are new developments that you are witnessing. Do you believe that this is an expansion of the world order that the U.S. still desires? Do you think this is going to be a failed attempt, or do you think they can actually realize that in front of the talk by the likes of Russia and China?
Look, in my latest book, West Asia After Washington, I talk about this as the wars of hegemonic decline, really, that these wars are precisely because there is an old order that's struggling to hang on to its power, and we see this outbreak of the war in Ukraine was really because of the expansion of NATO to try and dominate the whole of Eastern Europe and Russia, and with the Israelis, which is really the flailing out to try and secure the existence of this Anglo-American colony, effectively, in West Asia, in Arab lands, basically. As you said, they attacked Qatar, which is the main U.S. military base in this region, basically. But the day before Syria, and today Yemen, I think six countries this week that they've been bombing. And it's an extraordinary event, and most of the Western regimes are justifying it or trying to cover it up or trying to soften it, massage it in some sort of way. Yet the population of the world, including in the Western countries, is aflame. Really, the Al-Aqsa flood operation, for example, really, and the Israeli reaction to it, really woke up the conscience of the world. I believe that things have changed quite dramatically in the last 2 years. And the fact that there's a violent and vicious outburst by this Israeli colony against the Palestinian people in the first case, but also against all of the other regimes in the region, including ones that actually host the U.S. Military. Well, one thing that's remarkable for me is that, there was a retaliation by Iran against the US military base after they'd bombed Iranian nuclear sites here, but that was in a US base in Qatar. This attack by the Israelis was in the civilian area, residential area of Doha, basically. So there was no limit, apparently, to what the Israelis and the US would do. And of course, the Israelis had the support of the British and the US. We know they're denying it, but we know that's not the case. We know there was logistics support by both the British and the US in this attack. And of course, they switched off the air defense on their own military base so that the attack could be carried out. So really, there's no respect for the so-called friends and allies of this Anglo-American project in this part of the world. And it's really part of this, as I said, what I call it is wars of hegemonic decline, trying desperately to hang on to the global domination, the global dictatorship, if you like, of that order when they see things are changing. And real substantial powers like Russia and China, in coordination with the BRICS and the SCO and with the regional powers like Iran here, are posing a challenge to their dictatorship of the world. They can't tolerate that there are independent states in the world. And even if they're mildly independent, we saw, for example, Saddam Hussein was a collaborator with the US for a very long time. But when he asserted some sort of independence, they crushed that too. And they did it with Noriega in Panama. And of course, there are many, many examples. But this is the changing world we live in, I think.
Right. And of course, this show is going to be at in a few weeks, and there's going to be a lot of developments until then. But the fact that all the news and even the mainstream media were reporting that the Hamas leadership were targeted while in a meeting discussing the US's latest proposal regarding the ceasefire with Israel, the fact that Israel attacks such a meeting, what kind of message does that send across?
Well, I suppose the same message that happened when the Israelis attacked Iran, when there was some sort of delegation in Muscat, in Oman, you know, at the same time.
Before the sixth round, yeah.
Their attempts at diplomacy are entirely cynical. They don't mean anything. They will get what they want by force. They don't believe in reasonable discussion with people. I suppose you could say the same thing about the whole nuclear talks, really, where I've always been surprised as what was there that remains there for Iran. There was only the promise of lifting sanctions, which they never did when they had an agreement, you know. So what's there? There's a great cynicism there. Really, they wanted to disempower Iran as an important player, as an important influence in this region. It had nothing to do with nuclear weapons. It had everything to do with trying to unilaterally disarm an important power in the region, basically, which they simply can't tolerate. They can't tolerate independent powers. They would like to dismantle China. They would like to dismantle Russia. They would like to do all these things. They won't do it, but they simply can't tolerate independent bases of power. And this was spelled out in some of their strategic literature as far back as the 1990s. You know, I think that Brzezinski's book, The Grand Chessboard, was important in that respect. In many respects, they're following a formula from Brzezinski's book, you know, to destroy any independent seats of power, to impose this idea of full spectrum dominance, which is a Pentagon theme, and destroying disconnectedness. You know, they've written openly about these sorts of things, and perhaps they've massaged it with more smooth-sounding liberal language in the past. But then when they have cruder leaders like George W. Bush or Donald Trump, the open reality and the brutal reality of this global dictatorship they want to impose is more clear to everyone.
Right, and from the look of things nowadays, wherever Israel goes, America definitely follows. Why the unconditional support for Israel in the US, you think?
Well, I know that there's differences of opinion here, but in my opinion, the Israeli regime is simply an outpost for the Anglo-American empire, basically. Of course, dominated by Washington. So I know some people think that the Israelis are manipulating the US. I think it's the other way around. And in any case, of course, there's a hand-in-glove symbiosis going on there, really, that it's part of, it's their child or their outreach or whatever. Nevertheless, there is this. And of course, the other Western countries are really forced to go along with this too, because they don't have substantial independence. The Europeans, the NATO states, my own country, Australia, really, they're in a humiliating way, they're forced to go along with this, even though they may not like it personally. They may not like Washington being the dictator that it is personally, but they are scared. They're afraid of great damage that can be done to them politically and economically if they don't go along with it, you know. So it's an extraordinary time, really, because, as I said, these wars are a result of the fact that there is a regime trying to hang on to global dominance, which he thinks it's entitled to, an extraordinary exceptionalist entitled mentality. And you see a microcosm of that in the Israeli colony. That's my way of looking at it.
Right, that was a very interesting viewpoint. Mr. Tim Anderson, it was a pleasure to have you on SOAP.
Thank you.
We've come to the close of one other SOAP. Until next time, it's goodbye from me, Bahman Uray.
Welcome, dear listeners. This is Iran Radio from Tehran, and I'm your host for the next hour. Hope you will accompany us into the early hours of this morning. We'll start this hour's lineup with Let's Recite the Quran. The program teaches eloquent recitation of the Quran at level 2. After that, we have Islamic upbringing. The program aims to answer frequently asked questions about children and adolescents and their upbringing. Israel Watch will follow next. The program aims to examine and criticize reports and analysis by Israeli media on current events and issues in West Asia region. And the Ocean of Dua is our final program this hour. The program gives an explanation of supplications taken from various books such as Mafatihul Jinan and Kamilu Ziyarat. Stay with us for the next hour.
Let's recite the Quran.
وَإِذَا قَرَأْتَ الْقُرْآنَ جَعَلْنَا بَيْنَكَ وَبَيْنَ الَّذِينَ لَا يُؤْمِنُونَ بِالْآخِرَةِ حِجَابًا مَسْتُورًا.
القرآن نور وبيان، القرآن هدي الإيمان، القرآن مسك الختام، يا قرآن عليك سلام.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم، بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم، الحمد لله رب العالمين، وصلى الله على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين.
اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد وعجل فرجه.
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله. Everyone, brothers and sisters, dear listeners all over the world, listening to Arab English Radio right now, welcome to Let's Recite the Quran Kareem. Here today again with brothers Ali Nasir, Hassan, Hussein and Masoom. I'm here with you. Inshallah, today we will be practicing verse number 34, Surah Al-Ra'd, on page
253.
Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, hope you have the Quran with you. Please turn to page 253. And Surah Al-Ra'd on Surah Al-Ra'd, verse number
34.
Hassan, Hussein, Ali Nasir, and Muhammad Masoom. Ready, everyone?
Yes.
Let's go.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. لهم عذاب في الحياة الدنيا ولعذاب الآخرة أشق وما لهم من الله من واق.
For them will be punishment in the life of this world, and the punishment of the hereafter is more severe, and they will not have from Allah any protector.
That was a nice recitation, mashallah. Allah bless the reciter, inshallah. Okay, let's see what Allah Almighty says in ayah 34, Surah Al-Ra'd, on page 253. A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim, bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Wow, such a nice ayah. لهم عذاب في الحياة الدنيا ولعذاب الآخرة أشق وما لهم من الله من واق. This is really, really like strict, you know, serious. See, Allah Almighty says there is a punishment for them in the life of this world, and the punishment of the hereafter will surely be harder. And they have no defender against Allah Almighty. Guys, Allah Almighty explained about those who actually were disbelievers to Allah Almighty, yes?
Mm-hmm.
Yes?
Yes.
Yeah. And also the ones at the very last part of the ayah 33, if you take a look. وَمَنْ يُضْلِلِ اللَّهُ فَمَا لَهُ مِنْ هَادٍ. If someone is led astray by Allah Almighty, it means if someone is deprived from the blessings of Allah Almighty, from the guidance of Allah Almighty, okay, then فَمَا لَهُ مِنْ هَادٍ, then he will have no guide. There is no one to show him the right path. There is no one to enlighten his way. Alright? So now Allah Almighty explains about them. What happens to them? Those who ascribe partners to Allah Almighty, those who disbelieve in Allah Almighty, those who say no to the guidance of Allah Almighty, of course they will be deprived not only in this world but also in the hereafter. See, but Allah Almighty compares something beautiful. See, Allah Almighty compares the azab, the punishment of this dunya, with the punishment of
akhirah,
the hereafter. Why Allah Almighty says that the punishment of Akhirah is much harder than the punishment of this world? Why? Can you tell us? Anybody?
Because this world has